Welcome to Motivated to Lead podcast, helping you become a better leader. I'm your host, Mark Klingsheim.
Hi, everyone. Thanks again for joining us for our podcast this week. My name is Mark Klingsheim with CMO Partners. Each week, we interview leaders and they share lessons learned from their careers. Our goal is to help you become a better leader. This week, we're going to revisit a conversation that we had last year with Josh Macauer. Josh is an experienced executive. He's been a CEO of medtech companies. He is a trained physician, has practiced medicine. He's been a VC and has led the medical technology practice for NEA, a large VC firm in the Bay Area. Josh is an inventor. He has over 300 patents and patent applications that he's filed. He was co-founder of the Stanford Center for Biodesign, which he has been now named the director for that program. He has some great insights he's going to share from his career and leadership lessons learned. Looking forward to revisiting the conversation with Josh. It's great to have Josh join us from the Bay Area. And I guess first off, Josh, could you just give us a little bit of your background, a little bit of your story?
Yeah, sure. I'm a physician, engineer, entrepreneur, inventor, now maybe investor. my whole life's been focused on trying to create technologies for patients that improve people's lives. With, you know, maybe one, small deviations to things that improve lives, but maybe are a little bit more fun, like, wine technology. But
okay,
for the most of my career has been focused on medical devices and medical technology, either used by physicians or used by patients or people who have, you know, healthcare needs. And so that's been my entire focus. So to MIT mechanical engineer, on to medical school at NYU, and then took a job with Pfizer, working in the healthcare in their medical devices division at the time. Really exciting position in the sort of business development, technology development department and headquarters, and got connected to all the divisions. And that's really where I got a special assignment from the VP of Strategic Planning, CFO Hank McKinnell, who later became president, to do an assessment for him. And he said, we buy these great little device companies that are growing and have a lot of innovation. And then they, after we own them, they stop innovating. So what's going on? Why has that happened? Why aren't they as innovative? Why don't they grow as fast? What's happening? And so he gave me the license to be able to go find out. And I went through and I took the opportunity and interviewed all the founders of the companies that we had bought and their founding teams. And then I interviewed the teams that were now running it, usually replaced by, folks from within Pfizer or who had been promoted or what have you. And try to figure out what the differences are. And what I saw was very, very clearly there's a very significant difference, which is when they're independent, these founders were trying to solve a problem and they were going to find the technology that was the best solution to the problem. And it was an open field and they weren't in any way boxed in. But after they became a balloon company, or they became a, laser company, or they became, then it was like, okay, where else can we use a laser? Where else can we use a balloon? And that investigation was not successful, looking for places where you can fit a technology versus actually starting with the problem. And that sort of initiated my appreciation of that. You got to start with a really, any project, regardless of a big company or small company, you always have to take the biases out and look at the problem fundamentally itself to begin with and really understand the needs. And when you've got the needs really isolated and clearly called out, then you can invent upon it and bring the right technologies forward. And until then, you know, if you try to force a technology into a solution, you're not going to win. And so he was like, this is great analysis. Thank you. But prove it. Prove that we can innovate inside Big Pfizer. And so, again, took the opportunity. We created a group called the Strategic Innovation Group, and we built a method for doing this, starting with needs, going to, you know, it's sort of like obvious, but amazing how very few people actually do it that way, especially in big companies. And we proved that any field, pick a field, we'll go into it, we'll find what the most important needs are, and we will come up with something that is innovative. And we proved it through a couple of cycles and created a number of interesting technologies for the businesses. And around that time, started to run into the next big problem, which was the not invented here, or the issues of, wait, when we come up with a technology that actually competes with our existing technology, we want to kill it and, you know, and let a competitor do it to kill us in the marketplace rather than doing it ourselves. And that frustration led me out of the business. And that's what prompted me to become an entrepreneur. And so since that time, I've used that method for every company that I've created. That method now is the fundamental backbone of the biodesign program, which I co-founded with Paul Yock about 20 years ago. Mm-hmm. And that basic framework has led me to all my entrepreneurial success. So I've gone on to create multiple companies through ExploreMed, which is my incubator, utilizing that methodology. In fact, Corvin, which I co-founded with, Greg's invention of the Corvin, but he used the same methodology to create it, starting with a need. And we've trained, thousands of students and fellows through that program. And today I sort of have three ring circus of my life. My primary hat is over at NEA, which has been my financial partner through all of my projects. And I am a general partner there, and I run the medical technology and, health tech practice, consumer facing health tech practice there. I still am the chairman of ExploreMed, which is the incubator that I founded. And then I am, an adjunct faculty member at Stanford, still mentoring fellows and, teaching students in the program that, continues at Stanford Biodesign.
Yeah. So I'll talk to you about your free time. It doesn't sound like you probably have a lot. We'll get there later. Well, I think the interesting part about your background, you're an innovator yourself. You've got, 300 patents or filings in your career, which is pretty amazing to begin with. But you've done a lot in your career, and like you said, you wear a lot of hats, which I find fascinating. So, but we'll get into some of that. But I guess I ask this question to most of the leaders that we have on: if knowing what you know now, if you were able to go back and talk to that young, impressionable 22-year-old Josh and give him some advice, knowing what you know now, what advice would you give him?
I mean, I will say that I've been very fortunate to have some great mentors. And I did take a lot of really good advice. And there aren't many things. I mean, there are definitely things that I can point to along the way that I made mistakes at and probably didn't listen to all of the advice that I actually did get. But I think when if you can, as beginning your career, surround yourself with really great mentors who have the experience and the background that you want to achieve, it's gold. And I've, been pretty good about taking that advice and at times not, and just had to learn some of those lessons myself. But I don't think I would do much differently, honestly. Even the times when I didn't listen to the advice that I now retrospectively feel like I maybe should have listened to, you got to fall down and scrape your knee sometimes, and you can't just always get it right. And there's some value to, sort of banging your head against the wall sometimes, because it teaches you stuff. So those lessons are probably even deeper than the advice that I got, all the mistakes that I've made. So
sure,
probably worth worth holding on to those.
So thinking back to that first leadership team that you led, and you've had an interesting viewpoint as far as from even the work that you did early on, taking a look at leadership teams and how they operate and mistakes that were made and that type of thing. What advice would you give somebody leading their first team?
Yeah. You know, I think that what I see a lot, and I identify with it too, you know, my first CEO job, I was not qualified. And I don't even know whether anyone stepping into their first CEO job ever really fully is. You know, you feel like there's sure. so much new. And, you know, however you get there, there's domains that you have not led or run. Like, let's say you came up through the sales organization. You don't know how to do manufacturing or R&D. You know, it's always that way. And I guess the thing to have some comfort in is you don't need to know everything. But what you should do in the role is ask a ton of questions and learn, and put the best possible people into those roles as possible and make sure that they're all team players. And that last thing is the biggest thing that I would say when you create your leadership team is you got to make sure everybody's rowing in the same direction. And I would say that no matter how smart or potentially valuable someone is in your organization or your leadership team, if they are not playing as a team player and being supportive of you, get rid of them as soon as you think that that's true, because it is not worth it. And that, I think, was the biggest learning for me, is that I sort of didn't do a good job of that and had, you know, allowed some personalities to dominate me because I knew they were valuable, because I knew that they had so much to offer and I, you know, cared about them and their families and had all sorts of other reasons why I was going to put up with a whole bunch of nonsense. I shouldn't have put up with it. And I did get advice at the time, you know, don't put up with it. And I just sort of was like, but, you know, they know so much. And I did a little bit too much of that, too much sensitive management. I think at a certain point, you just have to do what's right and put the people on the bus who are all going to be heading in the same direction, or the boat rowing in the same direction. Maybe that's a better analogy.
Sure. Well, we're all in a boat that has been experiencing a little bit of rough seas in the last 7-8 months. And talk a little bit about that, just some advice you'd give a leader during this time.
I mean, you have to focus on the long-term goal and make the tough decisions as soon as you can. And I think we all those of us that lived through the global financial crisis, I think have learned valuable lessons through that experience that I've seen us get faster to this time around. Because the first time around, it just didn't seem like reality. Like,
right.
What do we have to do here? Why are we doing this? You know, but I think it comes back to cash. You know, when you have cash, you can survive. You're going to burn through cash quick, you're going to die. And if the financing markets clam up, you're out of money. You got the best idea ever, and if you can't raise money for it in this environment, you're dead. So unfortunately, that means jobs. Unfortunately, that means, you know, missed milestones, you know, unable to achieve certain expectations. But the whole thing turns into survival. And you got to figure out how do you survive this? What can be done? Can you move the ball forward or not? And then you got to make the tough decisions, and you just got to keep the show together. Because, you know, having the whole big ship go down really fast does not help anybody. Mm. And sacrifices need to be made. You got to take as much care as you can, but you have to make the right decisions for the overall business and try to, you know, do that. So that's, I think, the advice is look at the big picture, figure out what you got to do to survive for the idea, the company to survive, figure out what that team is, what you can accomplish. And you have to cut the rest. And it's just tough, but it's the only way to survive a time like this.
So to keep kind of your, and I'm sure you've been in a lot of situations where you've had to make some really tough decisions. What do you do just to get clarity during those times?
I try to, you know, latch on to a frame of what is likely. You know, when this all came down, you know, there were all sorts of things in the news. It's going to be over by April. And I mean, just, you know, all sorts of stuff. And I just, you know, had to separate myself from all that and just go, okay, what is likely here? How long is this going to be with us? What does that mean for the real spending? And come up with my own frame of what this plan is. And I think, you know, how are we going to survive it? What are we going to do? And what is possible? You got to build that model inside your own head. And that's what you got to execute to. And when you go back, and I think when your team sees, and I was actually a CEO of one of my companies during this time. So I had the direct leadership experience, you know, the opportunity to be leading a company. Sure. As the pandemic came upon us. And we were in the middle of recruiting a CEO for this company, but I was running it at the time that we were doing it. So I had the director's responsibility. And I think what people appreciate is transparency and complete honesty about what we know and what we don't know. You don't have to know everything, but you can say what you know. You can lay out the frame for everybody. It could be tough news for everyone, but people appreciate the truth so much better than being told something that they want to hear. And I think if you can land on a plan that is truthful, that is based in reality, you know, whatever, based in science, and say, this is how this is going to go, and then, you know, adjust based on new information as it comes up, of course, but keep everybody grounded. I think people respect that. And even if it means that their job may be in jeopardy or the company goals that we set forth are not going to happen, you know, even talking about investors, I think people appreciate leading through a crisis where you are really telling it like it is and getting everybody rallied around the challenge of what we need to do to survive as a company through it versus, you know, trying to keep it a secret or whatever.
Sure. No, that's great advice. So as you're thinking about the changes in the healthcare field and medical devices and innovation around that, what gets you excited these days?
I think there are some really big opportunities coming in Neuromod. You know, I'm on the board of SetPoint, and I'm an investor there, and this is going to change, I really think, the game for treatment of inflammatory disease. It's a first of its kind, you know, is a mechanism that's really differentiated, and it's really exciting. We just had one of my companies go public, one of my investments go public a year ago, which is also breaking some ground in direct-to-consumer med tech. And, you know, this is a thesis that I had about 5 years ago, that there's going to be opportunities here for med tech to actually get through on a consumer basis. And Ergo is a part of that. Willow, the wearable breast pump technology that I founded, is a part of that. And there's a couple of other investments, Dots, et cetera, in my portfolio like that. I think that the thesis with the right criteria is going to continue to play. Cause I do think that consumers are going to have more control of their own healthcare. They're going to use the internet to make their decisions and use online sources to make their decisions. And if there are technologies that can improve their health that they can access directly, you know, via the web or via Amazon, they're going to do it. And we're seeing that happen in the pandemic as well. You know, people buying, you know, PPE and all sorts of other things over the web. So I think so the sector of Neuromod, the sector of direct to consumer med tech, so to speak, I think is exciting. And I still think the fundamental medical device approaches and the big you know, disease states that we still haven't solved, you know, cardiovascular, orthopedics, et cetera, are still big. There's big opportunities there and lots of innovative solutions coming, you know, one of which I've worked on for quite some time with Anton Clifford is MoxieMed, which I think will really revolutionize early stage, the treatment of early stage osteoarthritis. You know, I just love stuff that change paradigms. I still see there's lots of opportunities to do that. And there's a lot of entrepreneurs out there with great ideas that I think are going to make it happen.
Great. So are there any books that you recommend to leaders and people that you, you come in contact with?
You know, believe it or not, I'm not much of a reader. I, you know, just a little bit dyslexic. So I think, I tend to, do not really read for enjoyment myself, but I would say some foundational books that really helped me, shape my view of leadership and business, are some of the books I got exposed to in my educational path. You know, I think, you know, still to this day, I think Porter's Competitive Strategy, it's also true. It's still relevant, you know, today. As you think about competition, I just think it's a brilliant, I mean, probably not so much the back half of the book, but probably the first couple of chapters about really laying out the thesis. Back half of the book's a little bit dated, but the front of it really spells it out. And I think it's very thoughtful. And a lot of that competitive strategy is based on, you know, the Art of War, which is also an interesting, and very ancient text, but James Clavell did a really nice job of sort of correlating it into the current business world. And I still think that there's a, you know, business is war. I mean, it just is. I mean, you're fighting for your survival. You're fighting to get new ideas. You know, you are fighting against all sorts of existing incumbents that don't want you to exist and have to navigate all sorts of resource issues. And I think that the Art of War is really, there's stuff that isn't relevant too. And I'm not into beheadings, by the way. I just, okay. But you have to like, you know, step back from the specifics of it. I think James Clavell does a nice job. And then, you know, other things regarding negotiating and like a book called Getting to Yes, I think is a great fundamental net book that can help you negotiate amazing outcomes by really getting to, you know, the fundamentals of the folks that are on the other side of the table and getting, and I've negotiated a lot of deals. And I think that the concepts of that book translate forever, you know, on how to get a deal done. You have to make compromises, but you got to think about what's fundamental, important to you to achieve and really differentiate, you know, what's just a position versus a fundamental. And I think when you can do that, you can negotiate anything, world peace, whatever, a good transaction for your company.
Sure.
So anyway, those are just a few that come to mind.
So outside of work, what do you do to recharge?
Yeah. I love music. I play and I write music. I play with a band when we used to be able to travel to New York. We would play in New York a couple of times a year. There's a little club called The Bitter End, and my band's been playing there for like longer than I would like to acknowledge.
very cool.
But yeah, I love music, and it's a real you know, place for me to go to be creative. And I love to cook. Love to do music and cooking and love wine. So,
okay. Yeah. Very cool.
Know, wine, rock and roll, and and cooking. Yeah, there you go.
So what's your instrument? What do you play?
I play the bass.
Okay.
That's my primary performing instrument, but you know, I tinker with whatever you need to do writing. So, but my real instrument these days is the bass.
Very cool. Yeah. So that's a, definitely. And cooking, you're at home a lot of times with COVID, so you have probably more opportunity to do that.
Absolutely.
So what parting advice would you give a leader?
I think you gotta be perseverant. You gotta persevere. I often feel like things that have failed, that I've observed, you know, failure situations. And I've had some things that have failed too, by the way. I mean, there's a reason to give up the ghost any moment. You just, it's so easy to do. What is harder is to learn from what you're dealing with and adjust your strategy as necessary, adjust your goals as necessary, and take the feedback, take the facts, and navigate what is a challenging course ahead and persevere. And I look at, you know, some of my best outcomes, we faced unbelievable challenges, and some of them are still facing those challenges. But you just got to get there, and you got to say never, you know, you're not, if you believe in it and you really think it can be a success, do not give up on it and find a way. And if you do that, you can achieve success. I mean, it all comes down to whether you believe in it or not, and whether that belief is based on reality. And if that belief is based on reality, then you can get there. You may have to change things. You may have to navigate. You may have to, you know, alter the plan, but never give up on your dream.
Well, it's been a lot of fun talking with you, and this has been, I'm sure, helpful to those that are listening, that are new or are up and coming leaders. And definitely wish you continued success with all you're doing and the many hats that you're wearing. And look forward to seeing what else that you are involved in the future.
Thanks for having me, Mark. Really appreciate the opportunity. Thanks.
Thank you for listening to the Motivated to Lead podcast. Please subscribe on iTunes. You can also see a video version of this interview at motivatedtolead.com. This podcast is brought to you by SEMA Partners, helping you find your next great leader.